Log Talk Radio.
Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we are once again live. I think I'm about ready to OD. I've done so many shows in the past 2 or 3 days. I'm starting to get a headache, and I can't stop. So I guess I'm functioning on some kind of strange compulsion. And probably my most intense compulsion is to learn more about these ancient monolithic structures all over the world. And I have pulled together our expert panel this afternoon, Solaris Blue Raven, Mark Eddy, and Barbara DeLong. Let me bring my guests on the air. How are you guys today?
Doing well.
Great.
Well, we can start anywhere you want. I was thinking of starting at Pumapunku. Actually, I wasn't thinking of starting at Pumapunku. But sometimes when you start doing research, it takes on a life of its own, and it takes you places that you didn't really initially want to go. Barbara, have you ever experienced that in your research?
Constantly.
It's almost annoying sometimes.
It's frightening. I will be on one topic and really digging in and getting my teeth into it, and suddenly it's sort of like something bright and shiny, and it's, oh, look at that, and I'm off, and it's terrible because usually there's been a purpose to my searching and seeking, but one of the things that I find coming up over and over and over again almost everywhere I look is the TOS material, so I know that's my long winter's night project for sure.
Okay. Well, what about your other project, the Grand Canyon? You know, last night when I was talking with James Horak and Crystal Clark and Myriad McDonald, that came up, and James had his own ideas about that whole thing, which was very, very interesting, but why don't we start there, since you've been doing so much work on the Grand Canyon?
Well, not as much as I will, but in 1909, a man named G.E. Kincaid, it was reported in the newspaper locally that he had found a cave that had a tremendous amount of Egyptian material in it, whether it's hieroglyphs, gold objects that were brought out of the cave, mummies, all sorts of stuff. And it was not just a little note. It was a huge amount that was given over in the newspaper to it. They led on to believe that there was a team of Smithsonians that had gone in and investigated it. And it's amazing because now the Smithsonian, though it is exhibiting artifacts from Kincaid's cave, they are saying that they never researched it and that most of the material is lost. And I'm finding with the Smithsonian especially, they tend to lose things they don't understand. Anyhow, the more I researched into it, the more it became obvious that there was definitely something here. And they did say that up to 50,000 people could have lived in the caverns comfortably, that there were many different levels of it. One article did suggest that it was they were Egyptians because some of the hieroglyphs did depict Akhenaten and his wife and his children. Another article did suggest that the people that this was really their winter habitat, that in the summertime they were out and they were tilling the soil and they were bringing their, you know, whatever they needed for the winter into there. One of the reasons that the entrance of the cave is so precariously oriented, because it's too large a rappel down from the top, and it's too hard a climb up from the bottom, is that the level of the river has gone down significantly, so it's not as, there's the access is not as easy. And one of the other very interesting things about it is that not only is it a no-fly zone, but they are saying that no one is able to go into those areas. And since 1919, when a parks bill of some sort was formed, but they haven't investigated it. At least they haven't investigated it to the degree that anybody knows about. They've investigated it. And one of the latest stories is they've recently released condors in the Grand Canyon, and the condors live in the caves, and so therefore you can't go into the caves. But that's just garbage. It's just garbage.
Isn't that
Barbara,
Mark?
Barbara, is the Smithsonian saying that the you know, what the dates of the artifacts are?
There was carbon dating done on some of the things, and it took it back way further than it would be expected, 10 to 20,000 years ago. But that's, the Smithsonian is not even admitting that they were involved in this, and yet they happen to have some of the gold artifacts that are actually that they are displayed in the Smithsonian. So while they absolutely disavow any connection with any of this, they've got the artifacts there, and apparently they are said these are from Kincaid's Cave in Colorado. So, you know, take that for what, you know, it's amazing, because the artifacts that were brought that are solid gold, that are amazingly gorgeous, are definitely on display there. And the other interesting thing is that it's not just the Egyptian. There's an idol dedicated to Buddha, or a Buddhist or a Buddha-like statue about 100 feet in from the entrance of it. And then the cave itself takes off almost like the rays of the sun. I mean, there are chambers that go off in a, like a wheel, like the spokes of a wheel, because they're very organized and they're very explicitly designed, and it's a phenomenal. There's a map of it, and it looks incredible. And yet, of course, again, nobody has investigated. I don't understand how it could not have been investigated. There are several hundred rooms that were discovered. And one of them that was explored for 854 feet and another for 634 feet. And the finds include artifacts that have never been known to be native to this country. And, you know, whether their origin was in the Orient or whether it was Asia, war weapons, copper instruments, sharp-edged and hard as steel. The main passageway is about 12 feet wide, narrowing to 9 towards the end, and 57 feet from the entrance. The first side passages branch off right and left, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. And these are huge, huge passages. They've been chiseled or hewn, but they're straight as though they've been laid out by an engineer. And they're phenomenal, and yet nobody's... Why haven't they gone in and investigated it? This could not possibly have been a hoax. And why would they have a no-fly zone over that particular area? The guy that does Scott Walters, who does America on Earth, tried to go in there, and he was prevented to go in or rappel down or anything like that. It is definitely off-limits. And if it's off-limits for the casual hikers, or I wouldn't call him casual, but if it's casual for those folk, why hasn't someone gone in with a camera and photographed it and said, look, there's nothing here, instead of just doing no-fly zones and forbidding people to go in?
Well, it's interesting that the Smithsonian tends to lose things, just like NASA loses things.
Yes. Well, this is another of those cases. I seem to be intrigued by and drawn to places where there is the denial by the powers that be, just like the giants. They've excavated the mounds that held giant bones. They took the artifacts, and those they've got on file, but the fact that the bones were giant, they've never claimed, and those bones just disappeared like you know, they'd never existed. And we're not talking two or three. We're talking thousands.
Thousands?
Thousands. Oh, gosh, yeah. There are a couple of places where there were literally graveyards where the giants had obviously had a war, and the bones were there. They were thousands of bones, and they were all giant bones, and they seem to have all disappeared.
I was going to make a clip of Michael Tellinger's YouTube video where he walks up this hill, and you can see in the stone is a giant footprint, just clearly articulated footprint. Couldn't be anything else but a footprint. You can see every digit on the of all the toes, and it's as tall as Michael is. I mean, it's as long as his whole body. So
right. No, they were here. They were here before the Native Americans came to this country. When the Native Americans came 15,000 years ago across that land bridge, they literally either integrated into the tribes that came over, or there were wars. And the Paiutes were the last of them that have any sort of legend as far as killing off the giants that were battling them for the land. And in Nevada, they've discovered the cave. What the Paiutes did was they chased them all into a cave. They set a huge fire in the mouth of the cave, and they killed them all that way. And apparently, hundreds of years later, when they were looking for places to mine guano, they found this cave, and as they started to mine it, they started to find pottery, and then they found arrowheads, and then they found spears, and then they found the bones of giants.
I wonder if the giants that the Indians killed off were kind of those that were left behind. I wonder if the real advanced giants left of their own accord. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out as a maybe.
I think that, in my opinion, the giants originated or started in some manner, shape, or form over in Europe and in that area of the country. And as the population expanded, they were pushed further and further and further up through England, Ireland, Scotland, and then they were able to, because of ice bridges or whatever, make it around to the United States, where they found a home. And I don't know how long they lived here, but they were intelligent, and I think when the Native Americans started to come in from the other side, partially they were, I mean, there are reports of them in the 1860s and 70s as being parts of the tribes. So I think that there was a sense of they integrated in, they blended with whatever indigenous people were here now, and there are still people now. In the Bible, it describes giants as having double rows of teeth, fair hair, fair skin, red blonde hair, and six fingers and toes on each, you know, on all their hands and feet. And there are people today that are born with those qualities. And it has to be that the DNA has been mixed in with everybody else's DNA so that we are a melting pot for sure. I mean, I know people that have the extra digits and the extra rows of teeth.
Wow. Well,
Barbara, just to go back to what you said about, you know, the giants living with, you know, Native Americans, you can go to one of the recent Ancient American magazines and see an article written by Rich Motes about Glenford Fort, and that's located in near the Columbus, Ohio area, and you know, he says that, you know, the artifacts show that the Edina and Hopewell shared the hilltop fortress for, you know, their ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it, you know, Glen Ford Fort was not a just a fortified hill, you know, like, you know, we expect, you know, people to go there during times of civil unrest. That, you know, they're just there cooperating together and, you know, having you know, this open space on top of a hill as a place where they, you know, have at least one burial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just up there, I like farming. It's not really, it's kind of like a misnomer that's called Glen Ford Fort. The walled-in hilltop is more of a, holding in a sacred space.
Uh-huh. Well, a lot of the mounds that we have in this country, especially in Ohio, had, I guess, nobility / royalty or people of great respect that were giants, and they were buried sitting up and facing, I believe, west. And around them, you know, were buried artifacts, and there is some indication that they may have been the ones that started the mound building. Now, whether they were the original mound builders, but I don't know if they were the original and only, but I know that they did build burial mounds, and they built them so that they could bury their chief or their leader or whatever you want to call them, sitting up. And I have articles about how some of these giant bodies were discovered with thousands and thousands of pearls around them. Thousands of pearls. And you just wonder, there is a part of our history that we have not uncovered, and it feels like people like the Smithsonian are doing a very good job of making sure we don't learn about that part of our heritage and our history. And it concerns me deeply, because if there were giants here, it's not going to outrage anybody. It's going to, most people will say, isn't that cool? And, you know, the history books are now at this point in time. Speaking, I taught school for 25 years. And knowing what the history books have in them now and what the truth about history is, it outrages me that they haven't taken the time to upgrade our history to be truthful.
Barbara, you know, what you know, you're saying about the history books is, you know, they say that, you know, okay, we got, you know, probably some chief buried in the mounds. Well, you know, okay, that seems to be true, but most of the commoners are, you know, I don't know if that's the right word, you know, just your average people were cremated.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do have a, like a stratified society, you know, among the Edina people.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm not saying they didn't exist, because I know they did. But this other area, this other leaf in the page in the book, so to speak, is left totally blank. And you know, most kids, when you say giants, they think of Jack and the Beanstalk. Or if they have a biblical background, of course, you know,
Goliath.
But Goliath had brothers and sisters. Goliath, in the Bible, there are tons of giants and giant races. So, you know, why suddenly, oh, no, it was the Native American came across the land bridge, and this land was totally empty, and so they set up their tribes and stuff, and then the pilgrims came and murdered most of them and, you know, gave them disease, and then, of course, educated them because they were primitive. You know, those initial discoverer people and whatever never took the time to understand that the Native Americans had a far more spiritual and a far more, if you've ever read 1491 about how the Indians were such an amazing culture in this country, and you know we just destroyed it with disease and everything else. And oh, let's look at Columbus. He was a great massacrer and everything, but we have a day to celebrate him discovering a country that wasn't lost.
Oh, that's so interesting. Our history, we've got a lot to learn about our history, and much of it's been kind of covered up. I'm going to play, I don't know how much of this clip I'm going to play. It's about Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and then we can trade our concepts and ideas and what we've learned about this. This is really an interesting area in the world. Let me play this.
3,000 miles away, in the Republic of Bolivia, stonework exists, which is amazingly similar to the statues of Easter Island. Tiwanaku is, in fact, so ancient that it defies modern dating techniques. It is estimated to be over 17,000 years old, perhaps the oldest city in the world. And somehow, the sculptures at Tiwanaku were constructed in the same style and with the same enigmatic expressions as their distant cousins on Easter Island.
A lot of the stuff with Tiwanaku you can see in earlier civilizations, all the way back, you know, before into the centuries BC in Peru. You see some of these same patterns, some of the same iconography, imagery, and you can see the ancestry of this.
But while tourists flock to the ruins of Tiwanaku, perhaps the most mystifying of all ancient sites lies just a few hundred yards away. Of relatively little interest to most visitors, Pumapunku is a field of stone ruins that both thrills and stimulates the imaginations of ancient alien theorists.
In my opinion, the most significant piece of evidence that we have in this entire ancient astronaut puzzle is Pumapunku in the highland of Bolivia.
While the pyramids at Giza are incredible feat of achievement, compared to Pumapunku, the pyramids are child play.
Logic does not exist at Pumapunku because there we have megalithic structures which just lie about this entire site as if ripped apart by some sort of a great force.
The blocks of Pumapunku were so finely cut that they once perfectly interlocked, like the pieces of an elaborate puzzle. But with the nearest quarry over 10 miles away, how did these colossal stones, some weighing hundreds of tons, even get here?
We are talking about the place 4,000 meters over sea level. That means there are no trees up there which you could use for rollers. Nothing grows except a few grasses and bushes.
I have stood in front of many monuments. However, Pumapunku takes the crown, because what we find there is so inexplicable, so inachievable, that the question remains, how was it done and for what purposes?
Well, let me get Solaris into this conversation. Solaris, I don't know. I don't know if you've really looked into Pumapunku or not, but just, I mean, wonder if you could comment in general on this whole area that we're delving into. It's such a big area. There's so much information here, and the more I investigate into it, the more I realize how much more there is to learn. It's just like I was telling Barbara at the beginning of the show, whenever you start out in one direction, you end up down some other avenue that's just totally different than what you thought of originally.
Right.
So, but do you have a general comment?
But it's like the tip of the iceberg. When you look at all these areas where they've had these sites, you know, to me, looking at the timeline, obviously they didn't have the kind of interference we have today. So insofar as assistance goes or divine, however you want to call it, like a download of data so that they were able to design these things, it's highly possible. I don't get the sense that it's anything really hardcore extraterrestrial, just my own impression, opposed to the other sites that I've looked at. But I do know there are so many different undiscovered areas that we have yet to look at, and some of them are actually beneath the ocean. So to me, it seems like we just have so much investigation to do and so much research. It's impressive, and I hope they don't keep clouding everybody from really discovering the truth of everything.
Pumapunku is this large temple complex that's part of the Tiwanaku site near Tiwanaku, Bolivia. Bolivia is kind of it's a landlocked country located in west central South America, and it has Peru to its left or to its west. Pumapunku, it means door of the puma. And there was this investigator that goes back to the 18th century or the 1800s or the early 1900s. His name was Arthur Poznanski. And he said that Pumapunku was about 17,000 years old. And he didn't think it was built by the Aymara Indians, which today our archaeologists say it was built by the Aymara Indians who didn't even have writing. Arthur Poznanski said it was built by American peoples. Now, when the historians asked the Incas if they knew anything about Tiwanaku, they said it was built thousands of years before their time. And the quarry for the stones at Tiwanaku is some 70 kilometers away. And some of the stones are broken. And so we got to wonder, what kind of force would it take to break these stones? Perhaps there was some kind of ancient cataclysmic event or something to that effect. Okay, and these stones are some of the hardest stones in the world, so I wonder how a Bronze Age culture would be able to cut these stones, Barbara. What do you think?
Well, I don't think they did. I had heard that Pumapunku was definitely alien of some sort, and that Tiwanaku was really a site that was built by the indigenous people to a certain degree, but with some influence. Isn't that where they have that great big wall that has faces of people from all over the world, all cultures, all races, all.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
and
is.
even they've got a little gray in there too, which I thought was cute. But those stones aren't quite as meticulously sculpted as the ones at Pumapunku. They're almost like they remind me of Legos that, you know, if you could lift them and you could slip them together, they would actually create something. And there's been a lot of speculation as to what it was, whether it was somebody thought that it might be sort of like a launching pad for some of their vessels, which I don't think is appropriate, because I think probably if they had vessels, they probably worked on a whole other technology that we don't even know about. Some man, I forget where he was from, but he took them and he put them together, and those pieces do create what could have been a hinge to a door, though I can't imagine what the doorway could have been too, because there's nothing there except all those odd pieces. But it does look like it was a factory of some sort. It does look like it was a staging area, and yet you don't see any of those kinds of stones in any of the other stone technology around the planet.
Barbara, do you have an idea of like how those H blocks would have been cut? And you get you know, some of the theories about, you know, laser beams are the only thing that could be that precise?
They did try to replicate that. They used a diamond saw and they used a laser. And with both of them, neither of them gave the kind of cut that you see there now. And those stones are thousands and thousands of years old. And yet they still have the right angles to them. They still have the angles to them. I would almost, even if they were liquefying the stone and pouring it into a mold and then popping it out, you'd see seams of some sort. So it has to be a form of technology that we just don't even have. It feels like it's almost something that melted the stone and then kept it in shape. I don't think that it's, you know, our lasers just don't cut that smoothly. They just don't. But when you cut something with a laser, you don't get that kind of a smooth surface that they have. And some of those insets are just so precise that you know, our stone people today can't replicate them, which tells you that we don't have the technology, which means that we don't know how it was done.
Well, I think what I've heard about the laser thing, the lasers usually leave burn marks, too. So it probably wouldn't have been laser. And the H-blocks at Pumapunku, they actually have a manufacturing mark on them. I don't know if you've seen that, but they all have this little symbol on them. And they have these incredibly precise surfaces. And some of them are very, very smooth. Now, going back to Tiwanaku, I think in the center of Tiwanaku is this sculpture of Viracocha. And they called Viracocha the great creator god of pre-Inca and Inca mythology. And Viracocha had a beard, which is very atypical of Native American people. And I'll have to look this up, but I would think that the Meyer material would say that Viracocha might have been an extraterrestrial human from Lyra Vega or from Orion, and I'm just totally speculating on that. Go ahead.
I heard it pronounced Viracocha, so I don't know which. I think you were talking the same person.
Yeah, Viracocha, or I've heard it pronounced both ways, but you're probably correct.
No, it's just that's how I've heard it. I could be wrong easily, but yeah, no, I also, it looks very Sumerian to me.
Oh, really?
The statue of Viracocha. If you take a look at Viracocha and then you look at some of the Sumerian engravings, there is a similarity there. I don't think he was Sumerian. I think that both came from the same source and you know, whatever. And I'm even going to go back to what I said a couple of nights ago on one of your shows, that I'm beginning to think that a lot of the statues that we see were actually life-size. They weren't meant to be, you know, a larger image of someone. They were meant to actually depict the person that was there. And I really believe that the vehicles that they rode in were interdimensional. They were not a spaceship. They were more of an interdimensional shifting vehicle.
Right. I mean, even you could even look at hyperspace technology as being interdimensional, because when you use hyperspace technology, you really, according to my material at least, you step out of the material belt of our universe. They say there's something like seven layers to our universe. If you could cut our universe open like a tree trunk, you would see layers that are just like rings in a tree,
mm-hmm.
which goes back to the whole thing that I say sometimes about these repeating patterns in nature. So I think it's the fifth ring where all the planets and the stars and such, all the material is. But there's an outer ring, and according to my material, many of these ships will leave the material belt into this outer ring where time is very different, and they just will jump from star to star, just like you would say, an interdimensional thing. They don't travel linearly through space, at least, you know, most all of them do. But now there's this other thing. Have you guys done any study on Easter Island?
A little bit.
I haven't done a whole lot of study, but that's one area that I want to get into, because it seems like some of the faces of Easter Island kind of look similar to some of the faces that are sculpted at Pumapunku and Tiwanaku. You know, they have that strange-looking large head and elongated skull and all that.
And the large eyes.
And the large eyes, a good point. Let me play our second clip about Tiwanaku. This is interesting. I think this is the one with Charlton Heston in it.
Next, we will visit the mysterious city of Tiwanaku, built at an altitude of 12,500 feet, with stones weighing 150 tons. This could be the oldest city in the world, built by a civilization as yet unknown. In order to unravel the mystery of man's origins, we must follow the path of civilization. A civilization is said to have spread from the old world to the new world, but there is evidence that humans were building cities in the new world thousands of years before history tells us. Traditionally, the oldest city in the world is thought to be Jericho in the old world, dated to around 8,000 BC. Yet in South America, the so-called New World, scientists are looking at evidence of a city that could be twice as old. Situated at an altitude of 12,500 feet, Tiwanaku is one of the most mysterious cities in the world. Traditionally, it's thought to have been built by the predecessors of the Incas 2,000 years ago. However, around the turn of the century, Bolivian scholar Arthur Poznanski began a 50-year study of the ruins of Tiwanaku. Using the science of astronomy, Poznanski came to an amazing conclusion. He calculated that Tiwanaku had been constructed more than 17,000 years ago, long before any civilization was supposed to have existed. Poznanski called this fabulous city the cradle of civilization. Even though the accuracy of Poznanski's measurements were confirmed by engineers, his conclusions about the age of Tiwanaku have never been accepted. Neil Steedy, a Mesoamerican archaeologist, decided to reopen his controversial investigation.
I met with Dr. Oswaldo Rivera, who is head of Bolivian archaeology. The doctor, though he disagrees with Poznanski's findings, was more than willing to help in every way possible so that we could retrace Poznanski's steps.
Neil visited Dr. Rivera's newest excavation site, the Acapana Pyramid. Today it's mostly in ruins, but the base is miraculously preserved and still testifies to the advanced capability of its builders.
The facing stones of this site are perfectly set with no mortar. We took a needle, and that needle we tried to insert at every point along the joint, and the needle couldn't be inserted. A perfect fit.
One of the most baffling questions for Poznanski was why they built Tiwanaku with such precision. This, he felt, was an important clue to the age of the structure.
Now, the ancients constructed the site with astronomical alignments in mind. As the sun rises each day, it moves along the horizon and arises in a different spot. To measure this movement, they built the temple itself as a giant clock to tell them how the progression of the sun was proceeding. And we can use those same astronomical alignments to date the site.
Poznanski observed that on the first day of spring, the sun rose exactly in the center of the temple, through the archway. Based on the layout of the temple, he deduced that on the first days of winter and summer, the sun should rise directly over each of the huge cornerstones. But he found this was not the case. The position of the sun was, for some reason, slightly outside of the corner markers. He wondered what that reason was.
En Tiwanaku y en otras ciudades.
In Tiwanaku and in the other ancient sites surrounding it, the architecture is perfectly aligned to the cardinal points. The buildings are deliberately oriented to the cardinal points. But if we measure each building precisely, we will find errors. I believe these are simple errors of construction, not at all related to the date of construction.
After observing the perfection with which this site is built, with 100-ton stones, to suggest that such things as the solstice markers are misaligned, I find incredible.
I think what we had is a pole shift in our past that may have de-aligned some of these things. For example, we were talking about on the first day of spring, the sun rose directly in the center of the temple through the archway, and I think the sun would shine right through that archway, which was amazing. A little more background information on Poznanski. Arthur Poznanski was born in Austria in 1873. He eventually emigrated to South America in 1896, where he picked up on his work on Puma Punku. Did you guys have any more comments?
Yeah, Mark, couldn't the fact that we wobble have something to do with it, and that there have been pole shifts over a couple, 10, 20,000 years? So could they possibly not have been going back far enough in time to be able to get the exactness? Because I believe it was absolutely exact for the time it was built.
Oh, I agree with that. And of course, like I've said before, the Meyer material says the Great Pyramid was built around 73,000 years ago. So I think we're looking at very, very ancient civilizations where there's been cataclysmic destruction that's occurred at various times. So I think you're correct. Very, very correct. Now, I have another clip. Have you guys heard of Brian Forster?
Yes.
Do you know much about him, Mark? Brian Forster? Have you guys, on your show, have you interviewed Brian Forster yet? Or
Thomas has a couple times.
Really?
He's gotten a lot of publicity for his research with the elongated skulls, and he's living in Peru or somewhere in that area, and he is studying the ancient culture of Central or South America.
Okay, I have a clip here. He has a lot of interesting clips on YouTube where he goes out to these sites and he films them and he walks around these structures and then he comments on the construction. So there's some little gaps in here where there's some quiet, but let's listen to this. There might even be a big gap here in the beginning where you'll just hear him walking around, and sometimes you'll hear the wind blowing.
So you can see we're in a very strange area. This block of andesite weighs 15 tons. The quarry is 70 kilometers plus off in that direction. How would it have been brought here? How could it have been brought here? This one is broken. And the break is not only ancient, but what kind of force would it take to break something like that? If it was a flaw in the stone, one would think that flaw would have caused the stone to break while it was being transported from the quarry 70 kilometers away. It could, in fact, be evidence of an ancient major cataclysm that not only destroyed the original site itself, but also those who lived here. And you can also see here where someone was attempting to break pieces off this area there. They basically gave up because the stone is about 7 on the Mohs scale. The hardest stone we know of is diamond at 10. This is about 7. And the surfaces here, again, are incredibly flat for such a big thing. How could some primitive Bronze Age or even less than Bronze Age culture have achieved such astonishing accuracy?
You can hear him as he's walking around the rest of the structure there, and you'll hear the wind blowing in the background and whatnot. It's very, very interesting.
So in the oldest work, again, these incredible precision surfaces like this, no ornamentation. It seems totally practical, except this here is a reoccurring symbol. To me, it seems like it's almost as though it's the manufacturer's mark. And there's only one location that I've ever seen that symbol before, and that's in a very obscure little cave in the Sacred Valley of Peru. But that symbol repeats over and over again, especially in the famous so-called H-blocks over in Pumapunku. Okay, we're inside what's called the subterranean temple. You see all the heads on the wall, on all four walls. And this is a depiction, supposedly, of Viracocha, the creator god. What's intriguing is you'll see that he has a beard, and that is very atypical of Native American people. However, this is not a fine sculpture, and it's also made out of red sandstone. What we're going to see through that gate is a much finer, much larger figure of Viracocha made out of harder andesite material. Some people are convinced that every type of human being around the world is portrayed in this subterranean courtyard, but the workmanship of the faces is really very crude, so that's very much a generality, and I personally don't believe it. You do see some people with headdresses that may possibly be from or similar to other cultures, such as the Olmec of Mexico, but to make a statement that all of them, or that all of humanity is represented in this wall, is really pushing it a bit far, I think. And a real problem with the subterranean temple we're in is that it was reconstructed in the 1960s, and so whoever supervised the reconstruction didn't really know exactly what it originally looked like, and they just took stone from the area and filled these walls in. These megalithic stones are probably original, but the other ones could have been from different buildings from different areas of this site. So that is actually very sad, because it's not a smart idea to do such as this kind of work. This makes the ancient builders' work look like a mess, when in fact what the ancient builders did was probably far superior to this. So it was the ignorance of archaeologists randomly picking stone and shoving it in the wall, randomly finding places for these heads to go. And it's really a tragedy, because this does not represent what this subterranean building or area originally looked like.
You know, it's interesting. This isn't the only ancient site that's been quote-unquote rebuilt. And I didn't know if you guys were aware of that or not, but I had talked about that briefly on one of our other shows. Which one of these, I think it was in Egypt, there's a temple, it's called Abu Simbel. And it's about 33 meters high, and it depicts four large figures in a seated position. Each one of these statues is 2.5 million pounds and some 67 feet tall. And anyway, they dammed up the Nile, the Egyptians did, and the original temple was located on the banks of the Nile. They cut this temple up in blocks, and they moved it up to a higher location, some 200 feet higher. So it's really kind of disturbing to me that they're screwing up these ancient sites. What do you think of that?
They did that with Stonehenge, too.
Really?
Yeah. I have pictures of Stonehenge my grandfather took in the early 1900s that looks nothing like Stonehenge looks now.
Really? I didn't know that. What did it look like before?
They were almost all of them knocked over, and those that were standing were braced up with great big pieces of wood. I'll send you a picture, one of the pictures, Mark. It's, you know, they're old. They're over 100 years old. But,
So, Solaris, do you think they're messing with our history?
Oh, absolutely. You know, everything has been edited, censored, and it's unfortunate. I mean, it's frustrating, especially if you're researching all of this information and you realize that most of what's out there has already been tampered with. And it's really frustrating. So.
You know, another thing I'm interested in is these elongated skulls, and there seems to be some relationship between the elongated skulls in ancient Peru and these megaliths. I got another clip here I'm going to play just a little bit of here. And this also may be Brian Forrester. So we'll have some little gaps where he's kind of walking around, and he holds his camera up, and he's filming these things. And then he'll start discussing them. So on YouTube, it kind of works, you know, where you can see him kind of walking around. But sometimes, you know, as a clip on a radio show, it's...
So once again, on the trail of the elongated skulls, elongated-headed people, and their relationship to megalithic structures. This person was from the Wadi culture. They were the great, powerful people prior to the Inca in the highlands. And as we have seen in the past, those of you who've seen my videos, where you find a great culture whose name we know, such as the Inca, or the Wadi in this case, we also find these people as well, or this phenomenon, which is called cranial deformation. So it's in places where we find these that we also find great works of architecture and engineering. These, of course, or I shouldn't say of course, but these have not been carbon dated. And so we don't know how old they are, but they probably are older than the Wadi culture. And like with the Paracas people on the coast, with the largest elongated skulls, and amongst the Inca, we find this phenomenon, which is trepanation, or trephination. And this is surgery done in the distant past. And in a high percentage of the cases, the individual survived the operation. Some estimates are at least 60%.
Brian's probably walking around.
And where you find the elongated skulls, as I said, you find engineering works, often in stone, at least in the highlands where you have stone, or on the coast, adobe, pyramids, or great structures. And this is in the Ayacucho area where we find these aqueducts. Now this is...
He goes on and he talks some about these aqueducts that are also there. Barbara, do you have any comments on these elongated skulls?
Well, you look back into Egypt and you see them with Akhenaten and his wife and his children. They've been around for thousands of years. I think that they have to. I know that the capacity of the brain in those heads was greater than the capacity of the brain in our heads. I personally feel that they were actually extraterrestrials that were here and integrated into our society.
Can you wait
I agree with that, and I was talking with James Horak last night, and he said the same thing. Mark, you have a comment on these elongated skulls?
Well, you know, if you read, you know, Frank Joseph's Lost Colonies of Ancient America, you know, he covers, you know, the ziggurats have a South American counterpart at Pyramid Mayor, and you know that it looked very similar. You know, was there some kind of transatlantic cultural exchange of ideas? You know, the one in South America was built about the same time as what was, you know, some of the unrest going on in Iran and Iraq. So, you know, could the idea of the elongated skulls made it from, you know, like that Middle Eastern Holy Land kind of area to South America about 2300 BC? Frank documents it in his book. I mean, it's you know, giving more proof, you know, of what, you know, Barbara was saying was, you know, that's what they were doing in Egypt. And you get the same thing happening, you know, in the clip you were just talking about with, Brian discussing the elongated heads in South America. Same, the skulls and the pure ziggurats are two examples of, yeah, the same idea on two different continents. Is that just a coincidence, or did they travel back and forth?
Now, they actually drilled holes in these skulls. I mean, not while they were, I mean, while they were alive, these people were getting a brain surgery of sorts.
Yeah, and the cuts were amazing. I mean, they were accurate. They were small cuts. They weren't, you know... it was clearly not, you know, they got their head smashed in and somebody, you know, cleared away the debris. It definitely, was, you know, little squares. The ones that I have seen were little squares. There may have been circles and stuff, but they knew what they were doing. At least it appears that they did.
Solaris, do you get anything on a psychic level from these elongated skulls?
You know, what I pick up on mainly is a beautifying technique. I think that a lot of the regular indigenous people were attracted to that appearance, and it is possible that they were trying to emulate that. One thing I'm thinking about with the elongated skulls is perhaps, and I'm not sure if they're connected to giants or not. I'm not sure if we've ever had any record of giants with elongated heads, or skulls, rather.
I would
think the Adena did that.
What's that?
I think the Adena did.
Okay.
They did what?
Do the cranial deformation.
Oh, yeah. But I do think the elongated skulls were associated with giants. Now, it's just my personal view. I can't make a strong case for that. What do you think, Barbara?
I've seen lots of, and there's a difference between an elongated skull and the ones where the Indians literally bound the heads of the children so that they did become elongated. And there's only one reason why you do that. It's because you see that someplace else and you want to replicate it. So
right.
I do believe that there were people here that had the elongated heads. I think in a lot of the old pictures of, I think one of the reasons this, and this is just my speculation, I have nothing to base it on, it's just my thought, but if you look at the crown of the pharaoh, it elongates his head.
Yeah, they always do.
So I'm wondering if the original pharaohs had to have the hat size done for them, and then when the human pharaohs took over, they just kept the same size.
Right, exactly.
Just my theory.
What a weird history we have. Oh, my, it's so weird. Think of these, you know, if this was a high-tech culture, what if these were like the original Google brain implants or something? You know, they're talking about having these brain implants coming out in 3 or 4 years. You know, what if these people had electronics and they were doing something like that too? I'm just throwing that out there as something.
Well, Baghdad battery seemed to be an electronic device.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we have such a weird history. Now, let's see. I want to play another clip. Talk about weird history. There are these giant stone boxes in Egypt that are just monolithic. And I think Brian Forrester will be talking about these as well in this clip. I don't really absolutely remember all the details, but they're cut out. Also, I think it's granite. They have this giant granite slab that's on the top, and then this giant granite box. And I think the mainstream Egyptologists said they buried bulls in there or something weird like that.
Yeah, I think that was featured on...
Okay, we've just walked below ground. And now this is the entrance to the Serapeum, which is where there are more than 20 boxes. Boxes are made of hard stone. Each one weighs more than 50 tons, and that's being very conservative. So as you can see, it's hewn. This area is hewn out of the bedrock. So you see the lid of this one, and you see the box itself. They were found inside of these niches just like this. So the main Egyptological theory is that they were the burial places of sacred Apis bulls. But they're more beyond the door. But what's intriguing is the interior of the box, because the precision is supposedly very 21st century, or at least 20th century. Look at the scale of this.
Can you imagine going to all that trouble?
So again, this is one solid block of Rose Aswan granite. Conservative estimate, 50 tons.
So, guys, what do you think? Do you think they went to all that trouble just to bury bulls inside these megalithic stone boxes? How bizarre is this?
No.
There's no bodies in these things.
Well,
there's nothing.
But also understand, in that particular time frame, they mummified stuff.
Yeah.
And there were no mummies of bulls. Now they've found mummies of cats. They've found mummies of birds, but they've never found a mummified bull, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I wouldn't think you'd make mummies of bulls at all. Now
yeah.
This to me,
it's a lot of
me,
salt.
to me, this is a huge mystery because I can't even come up with a logical answer to any of this.
Wouldn't it be wild if that's where they fermented their wine or something? When you stop to think about how mistaken we can be when we don't know what something was for, it's almost an embarrassment. And you know, stop and think, you know, generations from today, when things are wiped out and another culture comes from the stars and sees what's left of humanity. I mean, just think of the strange stories they're going to make up about our society.
I never thought of that. Maybe it's something totally down to earth and practical, like making wine or something. I don't know.
Well, maybe
a cellular regenerator.
Yeah, it could be
wow.
That. That's a great idea too. It also could be some place where they put meat that was being dried up or you know made into jerky or getting meat that was ready to go on the journey with the Pharaoh into the other realms.
Okay,
I like the regenerator though.
I do too. Yeah.
You have an echo, Mark. I just want to let you know.
Yeah,
okay,
is it me?
You guys hear it? Well,
let me
hear it.
I'm going to mute everyone and then unmute you and see if it goes away. It might have something to do. I was still playing this clip in the background, but it's all the way off. So let me bring everyone back on. There's 661. There's 203. And there's 303 or 304. Okay, let me bring this clip back on and see what it sounds like.
By itself is more than 10 tons, but we see the sorry?
The box is 70 tons, the lid is 30 tons.
Okay, Stephen Mailer says the box itself is 70 tons, the lid is 30 tons. But what we're seeing is we're seeing them in different states of completion. Some of them are very rough. That one is quite glossy smooth. But the ultimate one is supposedly right down here at the end.
And we can go down to sea close.
And we can go down to sea close, which is what we want. Whoa. Oh, here we go.
Here you get the great example of what you want to show that these markings couldn't possibly be original.
Oh.
Couldn't possibly be original.
No, those are very rough.
And here's the proof that Yusuf just showed. An empty cartouche.
Right.
Meaning this was not prepared for anybody. They left it open. Somebody could pay them enough money to have their title put in there.
Right.
So this is obviously could not made for somebody. Mark was put in much, much later.
Right.
And this is one where Chris goes inside and measures the tolerances to 2/10,000 of an inch. You just feel the surface. Flat surface, perfectly flat surface. In basalt.
Yeah.
And look at this perfect writing.
So Christopher Dunn is going inside one of these. Maybe one of these boxes. There's one of these boxes that's large enough that you can literally get into, I think.
At least when they opened this tomb, this area, in December 2012, the head of archaeology of ancient Egypt said to CNN, to MSNBC, to Al Jazeera, we don't know how this was done. And that's honest. We appreciate that, his honesty, because Egyptology cannot explain this to any degree.
Well, the idea that it was made for bowls, no matter how special they were, is just ridiculous.
Bowl. It's a lot of
it's
bowls.
Bowl. So this box in particular is amazing because I got to look inside. And the outside, or the inside, is as smooth as the outside. To the hand, it's flat, as in flat as a glass tabletop. And how could that have possibly been achieved when it is at least 6 feet tall, it is at least 10 feet long, and at least 6 feet wide, and at least 15 inches thick, and the lid is solid and weighs much more than 10 tons. How could they have moved that block of stone from the quarry at Aswan? How could they have shaped it? How could they have brought it down into its niche? And again, there are at least 22 of them here. There are supposedly other chambers beyond in that direction, possibly vertically down as well. What was the function of these incredible stone boxes?
Well, that's the big mystery. What was the function of these incredible stone boxes? Some of them 70 tons. They're 30-ton lids. There were 22 of these boxes. Who knows? I am hearing that little echo now.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound good. I'm gonna mute 304 and see if the echo goes away. So, did that echo go away? I think it went away.
Is it better? So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 304, if you have the radio on, that might be causing the echo. Is that you, Mark? Yeah, who knows? Maybe you could turn it down. Can you turn down a little bit, maybe?
It's NSA.
It could be.
No such agency.
No such agency.
You
okay, I'm
going to play. Last time, Mark.
I know every time.
Yeah.
I'll mute you just for a second there, Mark. I'll definitely bring you back on. But I'll mute Mark since we're getting some feedback from the other Mark. I'm going to play a little bit of this clip that talks about Egypt stone statues here. And I appreciate all my guests. It's a weird clip. Who knows what's going to happen here?
These are the bits and pieces of one of the largest sculptures ever created on the planet. That is a finger. This is the kneecap. There you see the feet, and there you see the torso. The weight of the sculpture is estimated as having been 1,000 tons when it was in one piece. The quarry is 200 kilometers away, and so the block from which it was carved would have to have been at least 1,200 or 1,400 tons. The question is, was it carved in place in Aswan and moved here, or was the block moved here and then carved? And we are reasonably far from the Nile, so how was it transported 200 kilometers? So there are his toes, and here is a smaller statue next to it. And the next step is to actually climb up on top.
Statue?
Uh-huh.
Statue?
Keep pushing. Yeah, I see. Thank you, yeah.
Again, this is Brian Forrester. He's climbing around on top of this statue. I think it's the Colossi of Memnon that he's talking about, which is actually two statues, each of which are 60 feet tall and weigh 720 tons. Unless I've got my statues mixed up. I think this is the one. Yeah, it's hard to keep them all straight, actually. There's so much.
So this is the biggest pedestal in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And this is, in my opinion, weighing around 500 tons. One solid piece of granite, rose granite.
So you see 500-ton base on which possibly a 1,000-ton sculpture rested. Here are his toes.
The only thing was done in that time.
That's right.
There was so many things in other places.
That's right.
So we need 5,000 there, 5,000 here, 5,000 that spot, 5. So the whole nation will be busy just pushing and dragging the stones, which is not convincing.
But pushing and dragging is one thing, then lifting
and
is
lifting.
Another.
Well, it's good to hear people thinking clearly and questioning some of these explanations.
So this is the Colossi of Memnon.
Yes.
One and two. And Tony's here in front to give us a sense of scale. The material used to make these is quartzite, which is very hard. The term quartz should give you an indication of the hardness of it. And the stone came from Cairo, which is 400 miles away. They are conservatively estimated at weighing 1,000 tons apiece. And what's most intriguing is the fact that with this one, you see it's made of multiple pieces. But this one, even though it has many cracks in it, etc., it appears to my eye that this is a solid piece of stone on a huge base.
So anyway, that's the Colossi of Memnon.
Mark?
Yes?
I have a question. I'm still caught on the bulls.
Okay.
The question I have is, I've seen a couple of videos that dealt with the chamber that they're in and everything like that, and as far as I can tell, it would have been impossible to get those chamber. How did they take all? How did they get these boxes that weighed that many tons into those positions? Because first of all, there's no drag marks on the floor or anything like that, and second of all, I don't think they would have fit through the door.
Oh, you know, the stone boxes thing bothers me a little bit because I just can't even come up with a vaguely reasonable explanation. They weigh 70 tons apiece. The lids are 30 tons. There's 22 of these boxes. Yeah, how'd they get them in there? Were they somehow put in place before the roof was put over it? Who knows? I mean,
this place is underground.
Yeah, it's underground. I mean, how did they? I don't know what they did. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, it doesn't to me either. That's why I asked. But, you answered my question.
Well, it's a very good question. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Lawrence Spencer. I've interviewed him a few times. He claims that he was given this document, okay, from this lady that called herself Matilda McElroy, who I'm going to take Mark off mute. Mark, you're off mute. Go ahead.
Okay.
If you have a question.
Barbara, earlier in the show you were talking about, those H blocks.
Yes.
Maybe they were a liquefied stone poured into a mold. Could those H blocks or the square boxes have been made that way, a form put into, the chamber, the stone gets liquefied and then poured into a mold there? I don't know. I'm just throwing out the question since we already talked about it.
I think under those circumstances, it would then be hard to, how do you get the mold off the box? Because it's in very close quarters. It's a good suggestion, but I don't know how you'd get the mold off the box under those circumstances.
Oh, it could be part of the technology that we don't understand from that time period. I mean, if the pyramid is already some kind of power generator, I guess you'd like direct the laser beam down to the basement.
Well, you could teleport, too. I mean, phase shift. Depends on what they're doing at the atomic cellular level with the frequencies.
Oh, it all sounds very interesting. I'm just, throwing out
possibilities. Well, that's how the universe works. So the universe is based on frequency. The way I look at it is the way I see it. Because our universe is frequency-based, which means if you have a certain frequency and harmonic and a resonance wave, you can teleport, phase shift, create things instantaneously through manifestation at will. So there's a lot that we can, as a civilization, as an advanced civilization, could have access to back then that people have forgotten about now.
I just put Mark on mute. Mark, I'm going to take you off mute. Did you have something else to say to that?
Well, Solaris was just talking about the frequencies. There's the legends around Stonehenge about the stones were somehow teleported, lifted up to put horizontally on the two vertical stones. Oh, that's been around for a long time. Going back to what Geoffrey of Monmouth, Thomas Hardy brings up the in Tessa the d'Urbervilles, the hum that is audible from inside Stonehenge. So
there's a There's a hum in Stonehenge. You can hear a hum when you're nearby Stonehenge.
That's if you look in one of the last chapters of Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, you know, written in what, I don't know, 1880s or 90s, you'll find that in there. That's what he's saying. James Swagger has written a book on the acoustics of Stonehenge. I think it's out now.
Very interesting.
Go to your library and pick it up.
Very cool. I'm going to mute again to kill that echo. And maybe this will be the last clip of the show. And this is on ancient machining.
Evidence of ancient machining technology in Egypt. This is a new book that I've just written, and it presents the evidence. At the Aswan Quarry in southern Egypt, we find, among other things, the unfinished obelisk, which would have weighed 1,200 tons had it been completed. Quite an amazing achievement, and something beyond the capability of the dynastic Egyptians, because Egyptologists tell us that these stone pounders were what were used to create. Then also at Elephantine Island, we find this amazing rose granite, single piece of stone shaped with amazing ability. And other examples at Elephantine Island as well. Just to the north, we have the Tomb of the Nobles. These, of course, were tombs, but these chambers were cut into sandstone. Not just columns inside, but hallways extending 30, 40 feet. And at the Ramesseum, here we have the kneecap and the foot of a sculpture out of rose granite that weighed supposedly 1,000 tons. And nearby, the Colossi of Memnon. The one on the left is basically one single piece of stone weighing 720 tons. The Dendera light bulbs, if they are light bulbs, are very intriguing. Here we see possibly a giant holding one of these. And then nearby at Abydos, these strange figures. As well, the Osirion, again rose granite. And astonishingly, it is several feet lower than the ground at this point. And at Karnak, which is a huge place, we have this massive obelisk out of rose granite. Now, the dynastic Egyptians could have made these columns out of several pieces, but the obelisk? As well, the remains of an obelisk whose core has been destroyed. Some theorize that ancient technology was used here, such as these obvious core drill holes. Now, of course, in modern times, we have tube drills, but did the ancient Egyptians have these? Or are we looking at lost ancient technology, much older?
Okay, boy, we got a lot of stuff there. Mark has a comment.
Did anybody notice the giant holding the light bulb?
Yeah, great point.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's depicted there.
Huh.
Mark, go ahead.
Okay, while I was on mute, you couldn't hear me run to my bookshelf and get out my copy of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but that passage about it hums is in chapter 58.
Okay, go ahead.
So
you going to read?
Okay. I get to play English teacher here for a second. They had proceeded thus gropingly 2 or 3 miles further when on a sudden clear became conscious of some vast erection close in his front, rising sheer from the grass. they had almost struck themselves against it. "What monstrous place is this?" said Angel. "It hums," said she. "Hearken," etc. And then, you know, it goes on to just say that they had arrived at Stonehenge. "It is Stonehenge," said Claire. "The heathen temple, you mean?" That's right there, chapter 58. So your audience can go to the library, look for it on
So there's a
half dot com, used copy on half.com, and I can't find out when. 1891, the book was written by Thomas Hardy. So there's, you know, kind of this, you know, like folklore legend, you know, that we're talking about with the acoustics going back, what's that, like 120 years or so?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and I'm sure that he's basing that on other legends.
That's very interesting. One of the things that Brian Forster mentioned there briefly was the Osirian Temple. And the blocks of the Osirian Temple are polished pink granite. They weigh in excess of 200 tons. These massive stones are stacked and organized into an incredible building. And Nassim Haramein talks about the Osirian Temple in great detail. Barbara, are you aware of the Osirian Temple at all?
No.
Well, this will be another area you can check into. It has a graphic, like this graphic depicted in one of these walls, that none of the ancient researchers will talk about except Nassim, because it's obviously burnt into the stone, like a laser. But they're not really laser burns. It's just bizarre. It's the Osirian Temple is 50 feet below all of the other temples in Abydos. It's one of the most amazing things around.
Huh.
Yes.
I will definitely check it out.
Now, you've been doing some research on the Emerald Tablets. Did you want to close us out maybe with some comments on the Emerald Tablets?
Well, Emerald Tablets it's called the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. They created the foundation for the Hermetica. And from the way the story begins, anyhow, and in the writings that are out there, that they were written by Thoth, who was a priest king of Atlantis, and when Atlantis went under, he took his people and he migrated to the land of Kem, which became English, where he ruled for 50,000 years. And the stories and the histories and the legends go back, take us back 50,000 years, which is certainly beyond our recorded time, so that what we look upon as ancient Egypt is really not so ancient after all, and this takes us back to a time when writing and hieroglyphics and numbers and counting and alphabets and astronomy all came into being. That's when the Egyptians started to evolve with those talents and those gifts. So it predates the Bible, which is interesting because a lot of the stories in it are very similar to Bible stories, but it predates the Bible, so you wonder where the Bible writers got their stories from.
Very good point. Solaris, why don't you tell everyone about your websites and your books and all that?
Oh, sure. My website's Night Shadow Anomaly Detectives, and my books are on Amazon.com. And once again, also, I've read The Emerald Tablets of Thoth the Atlantean. Very, very nice book. Nice energy in it. So,
absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice meeting you, too. You're going to be on my show, Barbara.
I'm so excited. I am so excited.
Yeah, Barbara's going to be on my hyperspace show coming up in October 21st.
That's Dark Matter Radio, and then you have another radio show, too, Solaris.
Raven Star's Witching Hour, yes. It's on Revolution Radio every Saturday at 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time.
Okay, Barbara, your radio shows and your books?
all on my website, BarbaraDeLong.com. Radio show is Nightlight. It's on Monday nights and then odd days in between when I have cool people to interview. And the book is Whispers of Spiritual Wisdom. I also did the Cosmic Deck of Initiation, which I keep forgetting to mention. But other than that, I'm here.
Okay, great. And Mark, tell everyone about your radio show.
Okay, it's in Open Canvas, and it's on Revolution Radio. And it goes from 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time on Monday nights. So tune in. We're glad to have a lot of people in the audience listening to our discussions about ancient cultures.
And I want to thank our four anonymous guests in the chat room and Nate for listening. And you're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.